Georgia poet laureate Judson Mitchum likes to quote Samuel Johnson, "I never desire to converse with a man who has written more than he has read." This philosophy fits with Mitchum's view that good writing is shaped from internalized perspectives of great writers. Find out how this affects the poetry initiatives of the man who has twice been awarded the Georgia Author of the Year, once for his novel, The Sweet Everlasting, and before that for his first book, the 1991 poetry collection, Somewhere in Ecclesiastes. You'll hear a poem from that book and others, included in his 2007 collection of poems, Old and New, called A Little Salvation. I'm Angela Elam, and I was invited back to WUGA-FM for a literary homecoming, where some of my earliest productions involved the literary magazine, The Georgia Review, so it was a treat to hear him also read from that. Judson Mitchum and I talked in Athens, Georgia in 2015 in front of an audience at the Indigo Hotel for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It's wonderful to be back in Athens. When we started talking about doing this here, we were trying to figure out who should I interview. An obvious choice would be the poet laureate of Georgia. And Judson Mitchum has never actually been on New Letters on the Air. But what I really loved is the fact that the University of Georgia Press is here, and we've got three of the books that they published. But his very first full-length book was published by the University of Missouri. So, I mean, how could I not choose Judson Mitchum? I mean, with that kind of tie, it just seemed like kismet. Can you tell people a bit about your initiative as the Poet Laureate of Georgia? Because you're working with high school students.
Sure. There are no set duties for the Poet Laureate. But Karen Patey, who's the head of the Georgia Council for the Arts, which administers the Poet Laureate position, has wanted the Poet Laureate to be more than a ceremonial position, and I think that's exactly right. So we have a couple of initiatives. My initiative is the one that you're referring to. I thought, well, we have the National Endowment for the Arts-sponsored Poetry Out Loud project, wherein students perform poems that other people wrote, and that's a wonderful project, but that's performance, closer to the stage than the page. I thought, well, how about the writing of poems? So we have instituted the Poet Laureate's Prize for the best poem, 30 lines or fewer, written by a Georgia high school student, public, private, or homeschooled, and we award that along with four finalists this year, unranked, and we have a ceremony at the governor's office. I hope this is a program that runs for a long time, so I'm setting it up for the other poet laureates to do a lot of work. But the poet laureate reads all of these. Nobody else reads them and makes the choices. And we're getting some very good work. So we're doing that, and Atlanta Magazine published the winner last year and published the finalist on the website, and that will happen again this year. Another initiative is trying to go into some areas that don't have universities to take poetry readings into those areas. You can see the life in these young poets, and you can see the passion in them. What you can't see is how excellent poetry has informed them. The young poets share the misunderstanding that the culture at large, I think, has about poetry. That is, a confusion about rhyme. That rhyme is both necessary and sufficient to make a poem. Where the truth, as I see it, is that rhyme is neither necessary nor sufficient. Especially is it not sufficient. So that I get a lot of pieces of language that are rhymed language, and they're being called poems. But what's inside of them is startling sometimes in what it feels and what it sees, but it is marred by the form. It's a privilege to be serving in this capacity, and I'm really glad to have been able to connect with some of the really good high school poets that we have.
I'm sure people love it. I have to congratulate you. I know in 2013 you became one of the members of the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame. And both Sabbath Creek and The Sweet Everlasting, both novels from the University of Georgia Press, won the Townsend Prize for Fiction. Judson is actually from Monroe, Georgia, but he lives in Macon now. And even though he went to the University of Georgia, his background isn't creative writing. He was a psychology major and, in fact, has 3 degrees in psychology. How come you didn't study writing in school? I guess you were studying characters any way you look at it.
I was not actually studying characters. I was studying rats.
So you were a lab psychologist?
I was a lab psychologist.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
And my
that.
Old major professor is here, Roger Thomas, and I'm old. He's really old now. No, I was a physiological psychologist. I was looking at brain function specifically, and I'm sure you'll all be interested in this. I was looking at the dopamine function, the nigrostriatal pathway of the pars compacta of the substantia nigra, and its interrelation with the dorsal caudate nucleus with respect to learning function. And that's a serious topic. But it had nothing to do with the writing of poetry. I studied that because that's what I was interested in, and I went from psychology to the writing of poems because I was trying to write songs for the guitar. And when I went to work at a small college, Fort Valley State College, historically black college in middle Georgia, I had no laboratory, did not have a university-quality library, as most small colleges do not, don't have money for laboratories. And I would have continued doing that research, but nor did I have release time to do the research. So I was just sort of hanging around trying to do things that I was interested in outside of academe, and that was the writing of songs. And I wasn't a very good songwriter, so I went ahead and concentrated on the lyrics and began to look at poems and to write poems. But I do want to say that 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it would have been unusual to have somebody writing poems who had studied writing. The creative writing programs are relatively recent. There used to be really no professional writers. The people did something else to earn a living and wrote. And so in that regard, I'm in the tradition of many writers.
Though a lot of people were English majors, not lab psychologists. I'm curious if you still play the guitar.
I play it every day.
I knew I should have gotten you to bring that thing.
That wouldn't work. I play it, but I don't play in public. I do not perform. There's a point I want to make about poetry with respect to this. The guitar is one of the great joys in my life, but I never intend to impose my guitar playing on you. And poetry can be the same way. There's no reason that people can't have poetry be one of their great joys in life. There's no reason that a public presence should be the criterion for the enjoyment of poetry. I really think that poetry is a joy in itself, just as for me, playing my D18 is a joy. So it's still with me, but it's not something that enters into the realm of profession or something that I would want to share.
Well, it is my job to impose poetry on people, so I'm about to do it. Now that we've talked a little bit about your interest in music, I thought it might be nice to begin with one of your older poems. I've got here your poems, Old and New, A Little Salvation. But let's start on the Otis Redding Bridge.
Okay.
Everybody in here knows who Otis Redding is. A Georgia artist, right? Everybody knows.
This is entitled On the Otis Redding Bridge, and underneath it, it says Macon, Georgia. This morning, when a woman walks home from the graveyard shift at the cotton mill, when she comes to the Otis Redding Bridge, coughing and turning her head so the snowflake dust on her shirt whirls off through a sheer gold sleeve, the early sun lays across the road. What I need is the voice of Otis Redding and the power that would let a man shout sanctified, tender and sad. Let him cry, angry yet shocking in his praise. I want to sing the cotton dust caught in the sunlight and the woman who is not slowed down in the least, by the momentary beauty that began as an old pain deep in her lungs, this woman who spits off the bridge and goes on.
You're listening to Judson Mitchum here on New Letters on the Air, and we're in Athens, Georgia, in front of a live audience. On the Otis Redding Bridge, Macon, Georgia, included in Poems Old and New by Judson Mitchum, called A Little Salvation. Talk a little bit about that work, because I find that it's an invocation, which a lot of your poetry is to me.
There are a lot of things that go into that poem. It's a longer history than you want to hear. But celebration, I think, is at the heart of what I want to do many times in poetry, is to celebrate something. And the voice of Otis Redding is so extraordinary, still is so extraordinary, that is something to be celebrated. There's something about music that is kind of an absolute that we aspire to. The voice of Otis Redding carries within it so much. There is the Otis Redding Bridge. Really, the way that came about is that I was at a poetry workshop in Atlanta at the Callan Wold Fine Arts Center, and I was there at a poetry workshop with Philip Levine and Richard Hugo, one of the two times that they ever taught together, two of the giants in American poetry and two of the great poetry teachers this country has ever known. And so I was very privileged to be there, and I took my poems to them thinking that they might recognize a genius. I had 12 poems, and Hugo was very uncomfortable because he was a very kind man. And he kept smoking and sweating. And he found one good line out of 12 poems. And he said, go home and study that line. And I did. But one of the things he also told me the next day, because he felt bad after the conference, he told me the next day, he said, you have a strong voice, and you should follow that voice. And one of the things that Levine told me about the poem that we workshopped the next day is that this poem was written indoors. This poem was written indoors. I saw him 7 years later at a conference after I'd written a lot more and told him what he said about my poem. He said, what the hell did I mean by that? I said, well, I don't know. But I did know, sort of. I needed to go out and look at some things, take a look around. And one of the things I did was go out and drive around Macon, and I got to the Otis Redding Bridge, and I thought about the Otis Redding Bridge, and I thought about Otis Redding, and I saw a woman walking across the Otis Redding Bridge, and I made up a story about her. And part of what happened here is, and this happens in a lot of my poems, is that the poem turned back toward the act of writing itself, toward poetry, where it says, I want to sing this, I want to sing this, this is what I want to capture. I do think that in a very real sense, a lot of poems, Wallace Stevens would say the poem is always about poetry. I'm not sure that's true, but very often it is, because it's the very nature of the speaking and the very nature of putting it on the page that always has to be foregrounded, it always has to be addressed as you're trying to draw out what it is that you want to say. The shape comes first, the form comes first. The content has to follow, really. And it's that inversion that is hard to learn, that you follow your ear. When William Stafford read here at the University of Georgia many years ago, I took him one of my poems, and he was nicer than Hugo. He really was. He didn't want to say anything bad, and he said, well, that's good, that's good. Keep going that way. Let your ear carry you through, and your ear will tell you what it is that you want to say.
Bill Stafford, a good Kansan, I must point out, by the way, even though he was the poet laureate of Oregon, he was actually Kansas born and bred, but I didn't realize it was such a signature poem, a very important one to your early work, it sounds like.
It was. I wanted to have one of the books named on the Otis Redding Bridge, but the author doesn't always get to choose the title of the book, so maybe that's good, maybe that wouldn't have been a good title, I don't know, but I liked it.
You know, you have this story that you made up about this woman in here. She's a mill worker. And so much of your work, your fiction, your two novels, are peopled with working class people and people who have a really hard life. Is this just what you observed growing up? Because I think Philip Levine would be with you in that. You know, he wrote so much about factory workers and people who had difficult lives.
Actually, Levine, he dropped me a note after that poem appeared in the Antioch Review. He liked that poem, and I think probably because of the working class aspect of it. I grew up in, as you said, in Monroe, which was a mill town, a cotton mill town, had two mills there. Of course, they're gone now. They're antique malls now, but they were functioning cotton mills, and my father worked there. His people were tenant farmers. His father was a tenant farmer and a carpenter who died on this campus working as a carpenter on the dormitories. I say this campus, I think of Athens as all the university. But then he went to work in a cotton mill, in the office of a cotton mill, and when I was a boy, I worked part-time in the summers in the cotton mill. And so I was able to observe that work.
There's a poem you have, it's included in A Little Salvation, and it's one of your earlier ones as well, called Where We Are. Read it, and then we can maybe talk about it just a little bit.
Where We Are. Coals raked out on hearthstones writhe like men. Lake weeds resemble a Madonna, and great rocks erode into profiles, smiling at clown-faced clouds or frowning, puzzled, as they peer far down at long, dry stream beds, unable to find old light. Blossom, starfish, mandrake, shadows in snow open their arms. Everywhere eyes spiral. In the leaves of water lilies they are amazed. In slow creeks, vortices, sleepy, a little sad. In wood grain, knowing, nearly sensual. In wings of hawk moth, blind. And hands are found in coral, ears in shells, the small breasts of young girls in tree trunks, skulls and walnuts, but faces draw us as though we were infants, to chrysalids swaying on the underside of leaves, to sawn marble and photos of the surface of Mars, to ice melting an old man into the wind, to hollow dead trees and shacks blank-eyed on hills. There is also Christ burned into hearths, into cloth, photographed in thunderstorms, forest fires, waterfalls, and found gentle in walls, the torn asbestos of a hen house, lichen of cathedrals. But this is not enough. There's the taste of dust churned up from a dirt road. A wrecked pickup has rattled down late summer. The dusk, like cooling iced tea, almost too sweet. And the truck's wake coaxing a crushed wing upward. There is rippling lake light slowing, how blackbirds coil far off like smoke, shadows of small clouds sailing in the fields. Always there is rain. It's slow coming on in a heavy ticking stillness, how it sounds on the old barn's dark tin roof, or dripping from trees afterwards when steam curves ghostly along the blacktop and new skies gather in puddles. There are paths followed at dawn through grazed fields flaming with dew, the paths worn smooth as the handles of old tools, and fireflies floating through the night, brief smells of plowed earth caught through diesel, or colors of sundown fallen in the hills, the cool air sharpened with coal smoke, dark coming early when something is found.
That's beautiful.
Thank
Where
you.
We Are, included in A Little Salvation by Judson Mitchum. And we're talking here on New Letters on the Air here in Athens, Georgia. Boy, you went outside. Philip Levine would be happy.
Yes, I want to say that's the first poem I published in the Georgia Review. And when I got the letter from Stan Lindbergh, I thought that's what I had worked for. And the whole time I've been writing was to get a letter from the Georgia Review. And it made me think, well, I might be doing something right here.
I noticed that your newer works, in A Little Salvation, New Poems, Oblique Lexicon, each of these has one word that you look at. And you were doing that a little bit in your novels, too. You had your characters looking at words and collecting them. But tell me a little bit about New Poems, if you can just give people an idea of what you're doing here with this oblique lexicon.
Well, I'm calling it oblique lexicon. I don't know that it will end up being called that, but I'm looking at it as a lexicon. It's really a device. I'm not sure how to describe it. I have never been able to write anything from a title or really from a subject. I've always written the poem first, found the poem, and then tried to figure out what it's about. And I've always given the poems titles after I have written the poem. And none of these poems were written from the word. The word was always added to it after it was written. So I'm still working on that, and I think I have 45 or so entries in the lexicon there, and I have about 50 now in addition to that. So it might be a book on its own at some point. But what I'm finding is that I want it to be a lexicon presented out of order, not in alphabetical order. I want to have quite a few entries on the same word. And I don't know what else to say about it other than to say that when you're writing, you work for a framework that opens you up, in which you feel that I can work in that form with that sort of procedure, and the lexicon has allowed me to do that.
Let's hear one of these. And I picked Forever because it touches on a subject that also comes up in both your novels.
Okay, this is a poem in two parts, where the second part is a relatively formal. It's a Persian form called the Ghazal. Forever. I will never forget Clive Waring and his wife, Deborah. Every term for a decade teaching intro psychology, I showed the same video. A virus had destroyed his hippocampus. He came home one day with a headache that would not quit. 3 days later, he was shipwrecked in the past. That day he came home. And the right now, whenever Deborah opened his door, having left him only seconds before, Clive leapt to his feet. He hadn't seen her in years. He'd swing her in his arms. He would sing. In line after line of his diary, he wrote, "Awake for the first time now, and I adore Deborah forever. Who will give us tomorrow forever? There's a moon in the window forever. What's the long night for, and who will tell us? There is no way to ask, though, forever. Will you think of me, lost in the old house? How can I miss you so, and forever? Will you wake in the night without sadness? There is nowhere to go now, forever. And whoever I am, here's my answer. In our small boat, we'll row out forever."
Forever by Judson Mitchum from A Little Salvation. And we are here with the Poet Laureate of Georgia right now. And this is New Letters on the Air. And we have characters in your work that lose their minds. They have Alzheimer's or something happens where they aren't. I'm thinking of the one guy who is disfigured by the Vietnam War in one of your novels, but people who get disconnected from their minds in some way. And it's something that you touch on, I think, quite eloquently in your writing.
John Gardner would like to say all art proceeds from a wound. It doesn't have to be a traumatic wound, as with a mental disorder or trauma, but I do think that art is one way of dealing with a wound. And many times you see that poets do that. Gardner was dealing with the death of his brother. Gardner was driving a tractor when he was 12 years old, and his brother was riding on the back of the tractor. And the tractor ran out of gas, and the brother fell off and fell under the wheels of the tractor and was killed. And Gardner wrote about that all the rest of his life. I think that is the sort of thing that happens. Of course, if you look at poets, you see how many poets killed themselves, how many poets had problems with substance abuse, how many poets had personal problems. the psychologist jumps in and wants to say, well, what's the sample? How are we sampling this? These are vivid examples. We know these people because they're poets, and we may not know whether they're representative of the whole population or not. What I do want to say about that, though, is that one thing we can see is that with great poets, the poetry may keep them alive and it may not. Robert Lowell stayed alive, and he was deeply troubled and deeply disordered, but he was one who died of a heart attack. He didn't take himself out, and that's a sort of a triumph. Richard Hugo stayed alive, and he had real problems. And Philip Levine was a great spirit who died at 87. I'd like to suggest that all of you go on YouTube and look at the Bill Moyers interview with Philip Levine. If you want to see a great poet, a great spirit, an extraordinarily funny man who came out of a hard life. Father died when he was, I believe, 4. And this is a man who took that hard life and used it and made it into a triumph. And poetry was partly what allowed him to do that. So that's the sort of life I would like to look at, is the life of Philip Levine.
Why don't we end with your poem that's in the Georgia Review? It kind of fits in nicely with what you were just talking about.
Well, this is a poem that is a short poem that I worked on for 7 years. And was much, much longer, and this is usually the way it works. It's a short poem now. It's called Alto. Luciano Pavarotti died last night, and now the arias on the radio grieve us home. And my mother, whose alto was good enough for the choir, who sang while she ironed or washed the dishes or worked in her garden, but absently, without a hint of performance, died at the same hour. A clear day, and the arias grieve us home. For some time, whatever she knew or saw, all she could do was call out in the croak of a hurt creature. But if my sister interrupted her with a favorite hymn, sweet hour of prayer, or whispering hope, she would raise up and sing all the verses, and she would never miss a note. When I turn off the radio, her alto is in the morning air. Whatever appears along the highway, she fills it with praise. And the day flares silver in the window panes. The pines flash by like years. Thank you.
The poem Alto by the Georgia Poet Laureate Judson Mitchum, published in the spring 2015 issue of the quarterly magazine, The Georgia Review. We also heard him read from his collection of old and new poems called A Little Salvation from the University of Georgia Press. We'll hear Judson Mitchum talk about his award-winning fiction in an upcoming edition of New Letters on the Air. Visit our website, newletters.org, where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Danny Moran, Cassie Vaughn, Renita Johnson, Abby Jamison, Timothy Larrison, and Jamie Walsh. A special thanks to all the folks at WUGA-FM who hosted and recorded this special homecoming. And of course, thanks to you for listening. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.